You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is Sally Bedell Smith. Sally Bedell Smith is the author of many great books about powerful and influential people. Her book, In All His Glory, The Life and Times of William S. Paley and the Birth of Modern Broadcasting, published in 1990, is one of my favorites. And since then, she's written about Presidents Kennedy and Clinton and several books about the royal family, including the brilliant Elizabeth II, Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch, and her new book, Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life. Sally Bedell Smith, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. I'm delighted to be on. So glad you liked my very first book, too.
Oh, gosh, I love
Paley
that.
Paley book.
That's a fantastic book.
Thank you.
And all of your books are tongue-twister titles, but nevertheless, I handled them admirably.
Yeah, you did that well. Nobody asked me to say it, the subtitle, five times in a row so far, so I've been spared.
Well, presidents, thankfully, have their terms in office, and then they return to private life, whether they want to or not. But Queen Elizabeth, you know, she reigns, or at least presides, over her empire for as long as she lives, which was almost true of William Paley as well.
Yes.
So is that one of the threads in your work that interests you?
I haven't actually made that connection. I mean, I think it's more, if you trace the arc through William Paley to Prince Charles, it's probably as basic as wanting to kind of get underneath the skin of these people and find out, you know, what really makes them tick. In the case of the Queen, it was this inscrutable figure that's been part of our lives for now 65 years and counting, and I wanted to kind of part the curtain and you know, tell what she was really like, what her sense of humor was like, what she was like with her friends and her kids and her family, the rest of her family, as a sister, as a daughter. And Charles, it was a completely different challenge. I mean, I had met him back in 1991, and I was so kind of taken aback by how different he was from the stereotype of the old fogey in the tightly buttoned double-breasted suit. And I met him by happenstance at a polo match, and was with some friends, one of whom was a dear friend of his grandmother, who, you know, walked on water practically. He worshipped her so much, and he just kind of did something very unroyal. He came up to us and he kissed her, and he was incredibly informal and warm and just completely unlike what I imagined. He even dressed differently. He looked sort of almost like an American, wearing a navy blue blazer and khakis. And I just sort of tucked that away. And that's illustrative of the fact that I like to find out kind of what other people obviously don't know about these larger-than-life characters and the real story, or new perspectives and new ways of explaining them. You're right about that parallel between the Queen and Bill Paley, but I don't think that hasn't been so much the motivating force.
Well, I would imagine that you wouldn't want to write a book about something you knew everything about, that learning and researching it is part of the fun.
Well, in the case with Charles, of course, I've obviously studied him through the lens of Diana when I wrote the book about her back in 1999, and through the life of his mother. But I guess I had a kind of an accumulation of questions about him, and just wanted to get behind this sort of compelling and kind of confounding character who was, you know, stereotyped and dismissed and derided for his behavior during his marriage to Diana. And and I was almost embarrassed to find out that there was so much I didn't know, and an awful lot of people don't know about him.
So you had some revelations as you were working on this book.
There were quite a few revelations. One that's been much discussed lately is the fact that, you know, when Diana was going through you know, really kind of a breakdown almost following their marriage. And they were up in Scotland at the family's home at Balmoral, and she was really just falling to pieces. And so he consulted his guru, Lawrence Vanderpost, the South African writer, to see how he could help her. And he suggested that they go down to London and meet with a friend of his who was a psychotherapist, which they did. And Diana saw him, but only 8 times. And then Charles ended up seeing him, unbeknownst to, I'm sure, his parents, for 14 years, which to me seems kind of surprisingly enlightened for the way the royal family and the British public in general viewed psychotherapy and mental illness. And so I thought that was a good thing. But there were a lot of things I didn't know, the kind of range of his charities, you know, kind of who knew that he gave Idris Elba of The Wire his start in life with a $2,000 grant, that Joan Rivers was one of his close friends and he called her Miss Potty Mouth, and you know, that he had a reach really that has extended all over the world, that he started a foundation, Turquoise Mountain Foundation, with Rory Stewart, who is now a member of parliament but kind of celebrated polymath. And he created this foundation and renovated the old quarter of Kabul, Afghanistan. You know, and probably close to 100 buildings have been renovated, and started a school of traditional art and employed a lot of people. Things like that, people have no clue he's done.
Yeah, and you know, I kind of wish, and that's what's nice that you wrote your book. I mean, it would be nice to know all those things and then not know other things. You know, I mean, we know so much from history now. You know, we know that President Kennedy got away with a lot of shenanigans, let's say, that, you know, today would have become public, as Bill Clinton discovered. And so we know a lot about Prince Charles, like way too much information in some cases. So if he ever becomes king, you know, will people be able to forget all those things the way I wish I could and respect his place as king?
I think so. I you know, I think he's come a long way since the death of Diana, where he really had to rebuild his life, and he had that sign in his dressing room saying, "Be patient and endure." His popularity doesn't come close to that of his mother or William or Harry or Kate, but he has gained an awful lot of respect, I think, as people have recognized the contributions he's made to helping disadvantaged youth and setting up funds for poor farmers, and you know, that they're just all these things. I mean, people, he's known obviously for being an evangelist on the subject of preventing climate change, and for naming and shaming architects for modern buildings and those kinds of things.
He's all concerned with those GMO things.
Very concerned with GMO, and you know, there are an awful lot of people who've taken issue with him, with scientific backing, and including his sister and his father.
Uh-huh.
But he does, you know, as I say, if he has one conspicuous fault, it's that he has endless faith in his own original instincts about things, and does not like to hear contrary points of view. And
imagine that
gets him in trouble sometimes. And but he has been working very closely, which is something I discovered since 2008, with the Queen's senior private secretary, a very accomplished senior civil servant by the name of Christopher Guite. And he started, you know, having sessions with Charles and kind of helping him work through this transitional period when Charles is, just because the Queen is stepping back, you know, year by year, and he's taking on more of her duties, not as the reigning monarch, but just stepping in for her. And they're, you know, more traditional kinds of things than he was typically accustomed to doing. And he has been eased along in this process. And I noticed something that it wasn't evident in the public press at all, but that the frequency and the intensity of his statements, his often, hyperbolic statements over the years, has really diminished in the last 5 years, and that's sort of in sync with this gradual moving toward assuming more of her duties. And we had the play King Charles III that envisioned this Prince of Wales becoming king and almost instantly violating the constitutional limitations on his role and being replaced by his son as a consequence. I think he's very well aware of the constitutional restraints that he just has to be above and beyond politics. I'm not saying it'll be easy for him, because he's had a whole lifetime of creating his own role, doing really what he wanted to do, his initiatives. He had the money for it from the trust that he inherited when he was 21, and he's had a incredible freedom, really, over the years that the Queen never had. I mean, the monarch operates only on the advice of government, and where, he would sort of dutifully, when he was railing against one thing or another, particularly back in the 80s and 90s, he would send things to government ministers who would object, and he would just ignore them. But as the monarch, you can't do that. You can't make those kinds of statements.
Well, Sally Bedell Smith, in your book about Queen Elizabeth, and in this new book,
yeah,
you talk about this, and I'm trying to remember exactly how. That's what I'm going to ask you to clarify for me. The reasons why we wouldn't just skip him and go to the next
right.
guy. It would be very complicated to have that happen.
It would be very complicated. Obviously, when King Edward VIII decided that he wanted to abdicate to marry the woman he loved, the British government was able to draw up the articles of abdication, and he did it. But it was something that was very disturbing to the royal family, even though it put the current queen's father in as king and made her the eventual queen, which I think was a good thing. Otherwise, she would have been a sort of fringe member of the royal family. But still, the whole convulsion that created at the time, I think, lingers to this day. And the idea of abdication to the British royal family, I know other royal families have done it in Spain and in Denmark and, Norway and other places, and even in Japan it's being done. But they view it as an interruption of the continuity that is part of the glue that holds the royal family together, and that if you abdicate or skip a generation, you create options that can give openings to people who want to get rid of the whole thing and replace it with a republic. So they believe in the saying, the queen is dead, long live the king. And the queen dies, her royal standard comes down, and the new king's royal standard goes up, and William becomes the Prince of Wales, and he waits in line for his turn. and they do have something built in that can accommodate infirmity. The queen will be 91 next week, and she is still riding on horseback, and she still walks unaided, and she, by every account, although she had, she was sick over the winter a little bit, but she's in very good form and is out doing lots of duties, so it doesn't look like she's going to die anytime soon. And if she does, and she's talked about this, I mean, it is the elephant in the room that is now being openly discussed at Buckingham Palace and in Charles's household. And if for any reason she becomes incapacitated, either mentally or physically, there is the Regency Act, which has been updated, and a council of people would determine that she was unfit to rule, and Charles would become the Prince Regent and would basically be king in everything but name until the time that she died, when he would actually become king.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking this week with Sally Bedell Smith, who's written extensively about the British royal family. Her books include Diana, In Search of Herself, Portrait of a Troubled Princess, a great book about Elizabeth II, Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch, and her latest book, Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life, an in-depth biography of Charles, Prince of Wales. Sally Bedell Smith, before the break, we were talking about the inevitable transition of the throne to Prince Charles. In your book about the Queen, you said that the Queen is not only the Queen of England, a position that would pass automatically to Prince Charles, but also the Queen is the Queen of the Commonwealth, which is not an automatically, hereditarily passed on position. Did I get that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, she's the Queen of the United Kingdom and 15 other realms that include big ones like Australia and New Zealand and Canada and islands like Jamaica. And the Commonwealth is something that is near and dear to her. It's the 52 nations, including even a couple who weren't original British colonies, but it is primarily former British colonies, and it grew over the years. I mean, there were 9 members or 8 members, I think, when she became queen, and she views it as, you know, as an association that promotes good values, good government, sane environmental policies, that it is a forum where, in her view, and in reality, the little nations have every bit as much power as the big nations, and there isn't a hierarchy similar to what exists at the UN, and so it's very, very important to her. And since when she became queen, her father had been head of the Commonwealth, which was brand new, and their own neighbors said, okay, well, you be the head of the Commonwealth, and it was pretty easy in 1952. And one of the things that's happened, it isn't automatic for the next monarch to become head of the Commonwealth, so it was very symbolic, I thought, when I went to Malta in November 2015 for the Commonwealth meeting, and the Queen very deliberately had Charles and Camilla front and center, and it emerged that the heads of government had pretty much agreed that it made complete sense for Charles to have that job once the Queen died. So that seems to be relatively settled, even though there's no specific mechanism for it.
It's not hereditary.
They want, because the Queen wants them to do it, they will do it, basically, is what it seems to have come down to.
Well, I have a history question for you. At what point in history did the king or queen stop actually being in command of the government?
In power.
Yeah.
Well, I think Queen Victoria, his empire stretched all around the world, was probably the last monarch to have significant power, at least power to the extent that she often defied her prime minister, maybe not on major things, but it is a symbolic role to a great extent, although this queen has, it's really more a question of influence rather than power. The three things that Walter Badgett, the constitutional scholar, set out in his primer, really, on the English Constitution back in the 19th century, was that the monarch's role with his first minister was to be consulted, to encourage, and to warn. And nowhere is it written or discussed that it's actually a matter of giving advice. So it's really the choice of words, I think, is crucial: to be consulted, to encourage, and to warn. And the Queen, although we don't know what's gone on in those meetings that she's had with all 13 of her prime ministers since she became Queen in 1952, the bits and pieces that have emerged from various prime ministers, because there's nobody else in the room, it's just the two of them, nobody taking notes, is that she's just been a fantastic sounding board. She's traveled far more widely than any of her individual prime ministers. She's seen world leaders come and go, and Charles also is, he's just as indefatigable a world traveler and has met probably just as many leaders. And so he has a, you know, kind of a really terrific perspective too. And if he satisfies himself with being a sounding board and not, you know, I mean, he'll probably ask more questions than the Queen, but she would kind of go to, she would go not much further than, do you think that's wise? And do you think that deserves a rethink? Or something like that. You know, that's how she would try and nudge them if she thought they were going down a path that might prove problematic. I mean, I was, in the middle of apartheid in South Africa, she played a really important role kind of around the margins of the Commonwealth nations, and they almost fractured over it. And she used power very subtly, but she was able to influence some pretty significant things regarding South Africa policy. I don't know what Prince Charles would be able to do in that regard, but I think, you know, I think he'll have, you know, he will, whenever he eventually does become king, he will reign with a different style. He's very, very different from his mother in terms of his temperament, and he will probably, you know, he may give more speeches, for example. He may speak more informally than the Queen. But he will not be able to speak out. Somebody who worked for both the Queen and Prince Charles said that their households were like two railroads operating on two different gauges. So he will just have to be accustomed to being kind of told what to do, essentially, rather than doing what he wants to do.
Do we know how the Queen felt about Brexit? Obviously, she didn't exert any...
No, we don't. I mean, the one thing that emerged last spring, right about this time when she goes out to Windsor for she takes her court out to Windsor, and she has gatherings at Windsor Castle with, called Dine and Sleeps, and they're people from the arts and diplomats and members of the government come. And after the one last April, a story broke that she had spoken in private in favor of Brexit. And this was later revealed to have been leaked by somebody who is pro-Brexit. So
It may or may not be true.
It may or may not be true. You know, I suppose you could make a case that the Queen might have favored Brexit because she thinks British sovereignty is so important, for example, just on that point. Charles obviously has been, you know, he didn't make any kind of statement or even any kind of elliptical remark when it, you know, regarding Brexit. But he seems to be more of a Europhile than the Queen. I remember there was one moment in the last 10 years when he took his entire staff over and he addressed the European Parliament, and he just wanted them to be familiar with the people running EU policy. And so they're very careful not to, you know, disclose much, but that would be my guess, that he would have been more inclined against Brexit. I mean, the thing that they really care about is keeping the United Kingdom together, and the Queen did do something in the run-up to the Scottish referendum, when she was at church in Scotland, and she did something that she never does, which is she walked over to a crowd of people after the service, and she just said, well, I think you all should be very careful, something to the effect, you all should be very careful about your vote.
That's interesting.
Was interpreted as, you better not leave the United Kingdom.
Well, of course, the Brexit has had the effect of reigniting that.
Yes, it has. And I think they'd be terribly upset. I mean, she made one, probably her most overt political statement of her entire reign was back in 1977 during her Silver Jubilee for 25 years on the throne. And she made a pretty forthright speech about the virtues of the United Kingdom. And it's obviously something she believes in. She believes that it's far stronger than, you know, than it would be if they were all separate countries. And so it would be it would be a huge blow, I think, to the royal family if Scotland were to peel off, and then in turn possibly Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but that's a whole different can of worms that's been, you know, created by the Brexit vote, the relations between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
Well, in your book about Queen Elizabeth, you discussed the 2006 film, The Queen, and reflected a lot on its accuracy. And now there's this television series called The Crown.
I know.
It's based on the early years, so far anyway, of The Queen. So you've seen it, and can you comment?
I have seen it. I actually worked as the consultant, not on The Crown. I worked as the consultant to the writer, Peter Morgan, on, I guess, the precursor, which was his stage play called The Audience, which was in England and New York, and it won Helen Mirren her first Tony, and I think it completely filled her award shelf with that, and she played the Queen again, and it was a fascinating play, and I worked with him for a year, and, you know, all about the then 12 prime ministers, and he really had to invent almost everything because nobody knows what's said, and my role was to kind of provide context and talk about kind of the dynamics that I knew of from my research into, you know, how the Queen dealt with her different prime ministers and who she seemed to be, you know, fond of and who was skeptical at the beginning and who she ended up growing close to, like Harold Wilson, the Labour prime minister, sort of you'd think unlikely, but she was very, very fond of him. And so I sort of know how he works, and, you know, Peter is a brilliant screenwriter and a brilliant playwright, but it's historical fiction, The Crown, and there are, you know, there's there are people he invents for dramatic purpose, for example, Professor Hogg, who comes in and to try and teach a queen who needs her confidence built. He never existed, and she, in fact, was much more confident and assertive. And
so that idea that she was, that she felt she didn't have enough education, that was
I mean, she wasn't educated the way men were, and she did, in fact, as accurately depicted in The Crown, go from Windsor Castle down to Eton College, and she did have pretty, you know, it was pretty rigorous tutorials in the English Constitution. She took meticulous notes, and but she didn't have a really broad education. She speaks incredibly fluent French, so there were certain things she learned very well. But when it was time, when she was, you know, when her father was getting ill, her two private secretaries, Jock Colville, who went later to work for Winston Churchill, and then Martin Charteris, who was depicted in the first season of The Crown. Unlike what was depicted in the TV series, I mean, they worked very closely with her, showing her foreign policy papers. She had her own document boxes. She learned, you know, kind of the things that she was supposed to master. So she was, you know, she was more well prepared than The Crown would have you believe. But I think to make it more dramatic, they had to introduce this fictitious professor, who ended up not being very effective.
Well, do you think that the series captures the Queen in any sense?
Yes, I think he's very good at sort of capturing an overall truth about the monarchy, if even as he invents facts and, you know, and conflates time and you know, along the way. I think he gets the character of the Queen very, very well. The set pieces like the coronation and the royal wedding are done meticulously, and he also got the significance of the anointing and the coronation and the sacred oath, and that really that's the basis of the Queen not abdicating, that she at that moment wasn't getting a crown put on her head, it was at that moment really declaring before God that she was going to serve her people to the end. So, I mean, those kinds of things were really, really well done. And, you know, I could quibble with the way the Queen Mother was depicted, or the way Prince Philip was kind of made to look more like arm candy when he had actually some pretty substantive things to do with the monarchy. Not her relations with the government, but the kind of modernizing the way the monarchy conducted itself. But overall, I think it certainly has stirred up a lot more interest in the royal family.
It's good for your book, I'm sure.
It's been very good. I'm very happy to be in the crown slipstream any day of the week.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking this week with Sally Bedell Smith, who's written extensively about the British royal family. Her books include Diana, In Search of Herself, Portrait of a Troubled Princess, a great book about Elizabeth II, Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch, and her latest book, Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life, an in-depth biography of Charles, Prince of Wales. Sally Bedell Smith, do you think that in the 21st century it is kind of ridiculous to have a queen or king of England?
No, I think you probably can gather, I believe in the monarchy, and I think, it's funny, as I've been going around and talking to people, there's a certain wistfulness that I detect in people. Why don't we have somebody who's the light above politics, and who is a symbol of public service and rewarding public service and the kind of glue that binds the country together in good times and bad, particularly in bad times. And
someone who's in power regardless of which political party.
Yeah, one of her top officials described the Queen, but it applies to the monarchy in general, that the sheet anchor that holds us, the sheet anchor that we hold on to in times of trouble. And that really has been true. And I think setting an example, obviously the royal family didn't set a great example in the 80s and 90s when all the children were misbehaving. But the Queen always has. And she just stands for this whole set of values, service and commitment and duty, and I think that's a good thing. It obviously, tourists love to go over and watch the soldiers marching back and forth in front of Buckingham Palace and watching the great parade, with the state opening of Parliament or when state visits happen. And but I think it transcends that, and there's an awful lot of incredible charitable work that all the members of the royal family do. What William and Harry and Kate are doing now to promote mental health and destigmatize it and encourage people to talk about their mental illness and their symptoms and get good diagnoses. Harry in the last few days has been particularly outspoken about that. And you can't underestimate the effect that can have on people, because they are such public figures and, I suppose, in many people's eyes, celebrities, that it can actually help people.
Right, not just celebrities for celebrity's sake, but celebrities to do something worthwhile.
Yeah, and they do. Prince Charles, who knew? Starting the Prince's Trust to give seed money to teenagers that were kind of wayward, and give them a sense of self-worth and responsibility and get them educated and employed. And, he's helped over 800,000 people. That's not exactly something to be dismissed.
Some visual artists, painters, they might paint an image repeatedly in different light, different aspects. And I guess to a certain extent that's what you're doing. You have a kind of a Rashomon approach to the royal family. You wrote about Diana. You've written about Charles. You've written about the Queen. Is it fair to say the same kind of comparison?
I think you'd probably find more consistency among the three books an accumulation of knowledge and understanding as I've delved deeper into, when I was writing about Diana, the Princess of Wales, I had a, you know, I wrote about the Queen kind of in a limited way, kind of looking at how Diana perceived her. And then when I wrote about the Queen, obviously I delved much more deeply into her and Prince Philip as well, and to some extent Prince Charles. But it was only when I kind of looked at Charles head on that I sort of understood that there were all these things that I hadn't known about. And so it's more of a building process than conflicting points of view.
Do you have more to say about the royal family? Will you write more?
I don't know. I mean, I wrote an awful lot in this book about William and Harry and Kate, and I think probably not.
Well, you know, I remember you used to write for TV Guide. I kind of miss TV Guide.
I do too.
I know there's still a magazine called TV Guide.
When I wrote for it.
Yeah, it's not the same as it was when. I loved it. It was a great. I read it more than. I think it was at one time the most read magazine in America.
I think so. I think it was neck and neck with Reader's Digest in terms of its massive audience.
So do you still, you know, do you still keep an interest in the television industry? You've written about it a lot.
Well, my son is now a screenwriter, so I have a completely different view of it. And I am interested in it, but I don't know if I would go back and write about it. It's interesting. I mean, I'm so focused now on kind of now that I'm out from under my cone of silence about Prince Charles, I can actually talk about him.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sort of, so I haven't really, I mean, I want to write another book, but I just haven't figured out what it would be, and it might be something completely different.
Well, this book, Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life, is really fascinating, well written. I'm so glad you wrote it, and I enjoyed reading it, as I have all of your books.
Oh, I'm so happy.
And I thank you for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Okay, thank you, Gary.
That was Sally Bedell-Smith. We turn now to Don Nunley. Don Nunley has worked in Hollywood as a property master, among other things, and he's worked on many television shows and films. And he's just written a book about the 1971 film Le Mans. The book is called Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror. Don Nunley, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much, Gary.
It's a beautiful, oversized picture book. The story is great and harrowing. But first, tell our listeners, what exactly is a property master?
Well, a property master is the guy that's put in charge of everything in front of the camera, except the actors and the sets themselves. He crosses over in the wardrobe, transportation, even effects. But anything you see an actor pick up and use that's special for the picture, it can be a wedding ring, it can be a briefcase, it can be a machine gun, or a snake, what have you. In the course of my 30-some-odd years of making movies, I think I've almost handled everything.
And how did you get into that particular part of motion pictures?
Actually, it was more or less by mistake. I wasn't looking to do that. I was looking for a summer job. I just finished 2 years of college, and I was transferring to UCLA the next fall, and I needed a job. And Hollywood, for the first time in memory, was so busy they couldn't supply enough union help. So they were hiring people basically off the street. Now, it helped if you knew somebody already in the film business that could recommend your name to a department that needed help. And my dad was working at Universal Studios. He didn't encourage me to go in the film business, but he knew I needed some job. So he talked to the people, and they hired me, and away I went.
What was your dad doing in the industry?
He was a prop master also. He'd been at Universal, well, at that time, about 30 years. And was doing all their big pictures. In fact, at that time, he was doing Spartacus.
Oh, wow.
I came and they handed me a post hole digger and told me to go dig holes for crosses on the back lot. So I was working on the same film, but not exactly in the same capacity.
You set the crosses for Spartacus.
For all the slaves they were intending to crucify.
Oh, what a great picture that was. So when you were growing up, then did you hang out at the studio and kind of get acclimated that way?
I wouldn't say hang out. My dad they didn't. They frowned on bringing family to work very often, but once in a great while, my dad would figure out that it was the right picture for me to come visit, and I remember visiting him on the set of Bud Abbott and Lou Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Oh, that's one of my all-time favorite movies.
Fun movie, and I got a chance to meet Bela Lugosi and, oh, let's see, who else is there? Lon Chaney Jr., who is the Wolfman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Abbott and Costello.
Of course, Abbott and Costello, which were hilarious. And that set, and my dad told me, was one of the most fun sets to ever work on because everybody was always pulling pranks on everybody else.
Wow, well, there's a book right there.
Yeah, it was fun. And I got a chance to lay in Dracula's coffin. As a 10-year-old kid, that's pretty big.
Oh, that's great. And so we're talking about the mid-60s when we got into the industry then?
Actually, 1960. I was 20 years old. Like I said, it was a summer job. And after working long enough to get in the union, which was 30 days at that time, the Taft Hartley law said either you got to join the union or leave the job. So I was thinking this was kind of a fun job. I could do it next summer maybe. So I joined the union, and then by the time another month went by, I was saying, this is kind of really fun. Maybe I could do this as a career or a living. So I stayed, and for 30 some odd years.
Wow. What before you got into that, I mean, were you thinking I will get into film, or that wasn't one of your ambitions? You didn't know. What were you studying in school?
Well, I was studying football, track and field, and girls.
Well, then the film industry is a good move.
Yeah. Well, my dad didn't really encourage me because of the long hours and the times away from home on location, the temperamental people. You know, none of it, he thought he wanted to spare me that. But he didn't realize that I would thrive in that business, and I got along just fine in it.
Yeah. So you and your dad both were among those famous little people that they thank at the Academy.
That's right. We're below the line, they call them.
Ah. Do you get an on-screen credit if you're the property master?
You know, I did on all my pictures. My dad, because he'd worked in the business at Universal for so long, they never used to give screen credit. They said the reasoning was they wanted to save that little chip in a negotiation with the union, give out screen credit instead of something else. But I insisted on it because I went out and worked independently. I left the Universal pretty much as soon as I could. I went over to Four Star Television, did a lot of TV shows, but not as property master. That took a few years. When I finally got my property master card, I was only 24 years old.
So what,
I was the youngest guy in the industry to have a property master card.
Wow. So what were you doing in television before you were a property master?
I was working as an assistant to the property master on the set decorating crews. I did a lot of what they call second man, which is just under the prop master, but you don't get the credit or the title. And I did, at Four Star, I did Robert Taylor, Detective, Zane Grey Theater, Wanted Dead or Alive. That's where I first met
Steve McQueen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so that's interesting. So you knew him before you got involved in this racing picture, Le Mans, you knew him from television.
I knew him, you might say, from a distance because, like I said, I wasn't in charge.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the, what they call, second booms.
Yeah.
And I met him on the set, but it was more of a introduction of a nod of the head and kind of a hi, how are you?
Yeah.
We never sat and talked. We never shook hands. At that point, I never dreamed I'd be doing a big Steve McQueen picture a few years later as property master. And I'm sure he didn't think this kid in the corner over there would be giving him advice.
Right, right. Interesting. So, I'm dying to talk about the subject of your book, Le Mans, but I'm so curious about your life in the industry. I mean, it's interesting because when your father was working at Universal, they had very few credits, and a credit sequence went by in about a minute, whereas now the credit sequence crawl can be 7 or 8 minutes long.
That's mostly because it's so much of the film is not created in a computer by a 4 rooms full of people.
Right.
They all get to do it. My dad never got his name on a movie, and he did huge. He did Spartacus, The Ugly American. He did Winning with Paul Newman. I mean, I could go on. His credits were incredible. Never got his name on a picture. And when I went back to Universal to do a film, they told me I couldn't have screen credit, and I said I won't do the movie then. I turned it down. And anyhow, I finally got my name on a Universal picture a couple years later, and I made me feel very good. Not totally vindicated for my dad, but I knew it's about time they gave credit where credit was due.
What movie was it?
A picture called Resurrection with Ellen Burstyn.
Oh, I remember that movie had a sports car in it.
Crash at the very beginning of the movie. Yeah. It crashed the sports car.
Were cars something that you were particularly familiar with? And
no.
No.
No. The only race I'd ever seen in my life before Le Mans was a drag race. And the reason I got this film, the film industry is a little weird. You'd think they'd go out and find the best expert in the field to do a particular film. That didn't often happen. I had just finished a picture of 1855 up to 1968, I think was the vintage of the film. It was a picture called Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, yeah,
and,
of course.
Faye Dunaway, and
it's directed a great
by
picture.
Arthur Penn. And the same company was going to make Le Mans. And since they were putting the money up, they had some say in the crew. Not 100%. Steve had okay everybody. And his production company, but they asked me if I would be interested in doing the next Steve McQueen film, and I thought it was a rhetorical question. You know, I didn't give him a chance to back out. I said, absolutely, when do I start? And then they told me what it was, and I said, the only problem is I don't know anything about that kind of racing. And Bob Rosen, the head of production, to his credit, said, don't worry, you'll learn.
Well, of course, the race itself is only 24 hours, right?
That's correct.
And correct. Did you actually shoot the race?
We did. We had 24 Panavision cameras mounted everywhere you could put a camera, helicopters. We had three on a 908 Porsche, which had never been done before. We had them in all the pit areas, all the paddock areas, all the private, you know, VIP booths, the grandstands, you name it. And the idea was to shoot about 65% of the movie the day of the race. We had a problem at the last minute because he was going to drive our camera car in the race, and at the last minute the insurance company said, no. Steve is the picture. Without him, we don't have anything. So they put the premium on his life, the full budget of the picture. Premium on his life for 24 hours was about $3.5 million.
Wow.
So needless to say, they said no.
Someone else drove the camera car.
Oh, yeah. We had two professionals from Porsche factory.
Well, was that car actually then in the race, though? I mean, so the car was really
actually in the race. And the cameras were mounted in such a way you wouldn't notice them. The cowlings over there had two aft and one forward. And they were triggered by a switch on the steering wheel. And we would come in and change cameras, not film, because it took too long, so they'd quick mount the cameras on and off, throw gas in the car, tires, whatever they need, change drivers, because they use two drivers in each car, and take off. And we actually finished the race. We were one of 17 cars out of 55 that started the race. So, and we placed in our class, I think, seconds or something. It was amazing.
So you could have actually even won the race if you hadn't been busy making a movie.
Well, one time, Steve wanted to do that. We called an emergency meeting somewhere around 2 o'clock in the morning to all meet at our pit and discuss something important. When I got there, the important thing was Steve was arguing that we should go to win the race for the camera car. And the producers were saying, Steve, we're here to make a movie. We can't do that. We want to be at a certain place at a certain time on the racetrack, and you can't do that and win the race. So Steve finally said, okay.
So what kind of a guy, before we get any further to the end of the story of Le Mans, what kind of a guy was Steve McQueen? Was he a nice guy, easy to work with, friendly?
Steve was complicated.
Yeah.
If you rode motorcycles or were another race driver or a stuntman, he was great. if you were on the crew and doing your job, he was fine. If you were the producers or the director, he was difficult. So, we started that picture without a script, which was a huge mistake. They brought in John Sturges to direct the film, who had directed Steve and made Steve's career, basically, The Great Escape,
right.
Magnificent Seven. So they figured he'd get along with Steve and he could control Steve. Well, that didn't happen. And about 10 weeks into shooting, Sturges got so fed up with the fact that McQueen wouldn't cooperate that he went home. He just left the set and went home.
He came back to California.
Never came back. He came back to California and went to work on another film. Sturges was a fine director and a very nice man.
This is something that's puzzled me for years. How could they make a picture without? How could they think that they could make a picture without a script?
Well, the thinking goes to the fact they had the biggest movie star in the world doing a passion project about racing. They had Bullet already in the can, making millions of dollars, and people thinking Fast Cars and Steve McQueen were synonymous. And the studio just figured somehow they'd make it work, because Sturges and McQueen had to work on The Great Escape. They didn't have a finished script on that picture. Of course, they had a good story to go with.
I find that hard to believe. It's such a well-written picture.
Yeah, well, it's not uncommon not to have a totally finished script, but it is uncommon not to have a full outline or cast a leading lady for 8 weeks, 9 weeks into the production. Not one word of dialogue shot in the first 8 or 9 weeks of shooting. I mean, it was bizarre.
Well, the movie, definitely reflects that. I mean, there's lots and lots of, almost, except for the noise of the sound effects, it's a pretty silent picture for much of the film.
Exactly. Steve wanted to make a docudrama, I believe. He had made Any Given Sunday that was extremely successful about motorcycles.
Yeah, that's a great picture.
Which was a documentary, a docudrama. And he had the same idea. He wanted to make the pure racing picture. Well, it was too big a project for that. They needed a story. Grand Prix had a great story. I love Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Had a good story. All those films. But he had in mind to make a different kind of film.
He didn't want a soap opera kind of picture.
Yeah, the film we made is pure. And the racing stuff will never be equal. Nowadays, when they have a racing sequence, they get the computers going, and to me it all looks like a cartoon. So the stuff we have is really good.
Yeah. Oh no. That's one of the interesting parts about movies now. Because they can do anything in the movies, it doesn't ever have that feeling of authenticity that a movie like Le Mans has.
Yeah, and writing this book, which became a really interesting project for me, I shot hundreds of pictures on the stills on the set, so I could match different parts of the race, different hours of the race. And a lot of candid stuff with Steve and the crew. And I talked to a couple people, and they looked at some of my pictures, and they said, really, this requires a book. And the stories you tell about making the film would make a good story. So I think we've got a book here that'll appeal to movie buffs, Steve McQueen buffs, and racing buffs. It seems to fill those gaps pretty good. And I'm very happy with the book. So the look of the book, the feel of the book. The publisher has done several books on cars, and Dalton Watson Fine Books has put together, to me, a beautiful piece of art.
Oh yeah, it really is. It's a coffee table book, and I love the layout. And so, how much of it did you work with art directors to put this book together?
We had Jody Ellis, who was kind of the art director. She came up with the color design and did most of the layout with our input. She was terrific to work with. Marshall Terrell, who helped me write the book, has written several books on Steve McQueen. And the publishers has several books out on Steve McQueen and cars. So he was perfect. And like I said, Dalton Watson, the name of the publisher, is synonymous with fine classic coffee table books.
Well, Don Nunley, tell us, did things go smoothly on the making of this picture? Everything was just a piece of cake. It was all just lovely. And
well, it's the first movie I've ever been on. And on the final day of shooting, they hollered, "It's a wrap." Everybody scattered. Nobody came over and said, "Great working with you. What a great opportunity this was. How much fun. And we'll meet you at the wrap party," because there wasn't one.
No party.
It's over. And the studio, I'm sure, was breathing a huge sigh of relief because they had a big investment. They went way over budget. Had thousands and thousands of feet of film to edit. They did get Michelle Legrand to do the music. So they put together the best project they could, and it came out as a disappointment, but it held on and become kind of a cult classic.
Yeah, do you think Steve McQueen would be surprised to know how highly regarded the movie is today?
I think he'd be pleased. I really do, because I think it's his dream fulfilled much more than the studio.
Was anyone injured on the making of the picture?
Yes, unfortunately. There was a marshal that was killed at a corner. I don't know exactly the circumstances. It was way down the track from me, but somehow he got involved in a wreck. And then filming with one of the race drivers, we crashed a 917. David Piper was driving, and he ended up losing a leg.
Oh, that's terrible.
It's very dangerous. I mean, Steve was actually driving those cars after the... Because the insurance company said he could drive it if we were filming him specifically driving the car. So Steve was driving 917 Porsches at 220 miles an hour down the Malzahn Street with a camera sometimes strapped in front of it. Pretty wild stuff.
So you didn't do anything where, like, he would just drive slow and then you'd, you know, speed up the film?
No. It's all real, all the speed and the... We mounted microphones and Niagara recorders in the cars. We got wonderful sound. And we have a new Blu-ray copy of this out, the movie you can buy and look at. It's worth looking at.
Oh, it really is. I mean, you know, it's a beautiful movie. It maybe isn't the most dramatically satisfying movie, but it's visually very satisfying.
Right. It was a great opportunity to work on it with Steve and to work for Cinema Center Films again. Writing this book with Marshall has been an incredible opportunity. And so far, everybody I've talked to, of course, I don't know if they tell me the truth, but everybody I've talked to seems to like the book very much.
Well, I like it very much. It's called Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror. And the author, my guest, Don Nunley. Don Nunley, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
I appreciated your call, and I look forward to hearing the podcast.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program. Come back and see us again next week. I want to thank my guests, Sally Bedell-Smith, author of Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life, and Don Nunley, author of Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.